This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug-bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
All right, this is embarrassing. A dude wrote in. This is kind of like stunningly embarrassing. But a guy wrote in, and he's driving all around the place. He says he drove from northwest Wisconsin through the prairie provinces of Canada into the Yukon, all the way to the Alaska coast. 10,000 miles of highway. Listened to a bunch of podcast episodes and decided he needed to scold me about attributing a quote to Aldo Leopold that Aldo Leopold did not say. The quote is, ethical behavior is doing the right thing when no one else is watching, even when doing the wrong thing is legal, which I've quoted 1,000 times. He says, Leopold never said such a thing, ever. Now, he like goes on to be real mean to me. This guy's name's Keith. But then you could tell that he had the same problem, because I have searched through the Leopold archives in Madison, Wisconsin, while I was writing on a related topic, and I found no such quote anywhere in his writings or speeches. He scoured all of his works, doesn't find those words. Last year, after seeing an anti-hunting group and a pro-hunting group both use that quote in the same week, attributing it to Leopold, I decided to answer the question once and for all. I contacted an old associate, Kurt Mine, the world's greatest Leopold authority, a trustee of the Leopold Foundation, a professor of ecology at University of Wisconsin, the author of the definitive Leopold biography. He doesn't know where that quote came from either. He has read every quotable word Leopold ever wrote or said.
Gosh, I feel like in Bugle Magazine's column,
dude,
what is that column called? Ethics or Situation Ethics, I believe, is the column. Come on, someone help me out. Nobody else reads Bugle?
No, I know I
want to say that quote attributed to Aldo Leopold is like in the header of that column.
I've been reading that son of a bitch in quote for not my whole life, but a lot of it. I got turned on to Aldo Leopold. I could tell you the year I got turned on to Aldo Leopold would have been like 1996. The reason I'm thinking of that year, because that was the first year we tried to cook a deer's tongue, which we'll be talking about shortly. Another thing, research just came out. They've been doing this extensive study of lynx and fishers.
Hold on. Are we done with the quote?
Oh, you want to talk about that more?
That's it?
No, go ahead.
Well, did you do after I just feel you got like the email?
I feel like he's probably right. As rude as he is. Here's how he ends his email. Aldo was a great man and a deep, deep thinker, but he never said what you keep saying. He said, stop it. That's how he ends it.
Just straight talk.
Stop it.
Interesting.
Sounds like my daughter. Stop it.
Oh, I think we're going to get...
You might get a follow-up email
on
that one.
Well, I didn't say his last name.
No.
How many dudes are running around named Keith?
No, from other people.
How many dudes are driving around 10,000-mile loops named Keith?
I believe that this will be his favorite podcast of all time.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, he'll eat it up. He'll eat it up.
This one's
because
for you,
he's
Keith.
Like, yeah,
that was
I'm
me.
Right. You're wrong.
This one's for you.
Yeah. He's got a lot of he's one of those dudes that is like in a, you get to the bottom of his email and he has a lot of logos of his affiliations. Like, you know, you go on like hunting and fishing chat rooms, forums, everybody ends with like a quote.
Sure.
Like 45 ACP because shooting twice is stupid. Stuff like that. Like guys will like have a quote that like really sums up their personality. he runs with like his affiliations. I like the guy because he's the kind of guy that rather than sitting there being annoyed, he's like, you know what? He'd probably like to know. I'm going to send him a note.
But in his email,
stop like, it.
The bottom tagline, he doesn't have any Leopold quotes.
No. I'm going to put that quote in the bottom of my thing, and I was going to say that I said it. now that no one knows
Stephen Rinella.
Now that no one knows where it came from.
Yeah, maybe he's just giving you permission to just own that one.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I'm going to start making that I said it.
And after your quote, says Steve Rinella, and then it says, thank you, Keith.
Here's another quote that probably isn't true, but I heard that Sammy Hagar, have we talked about this before, Giannis?
I don't think so.
I heard that Sammy Hagar, and I haven't looked up to see if he said this, it kind of doesn't make sense, but I heard that Sammy Hagar said that his lyrics come from thinking he knew what someone was saying in a song and then learned what they're actually saying and then just took what he thought they were saying and made it a song.
So, kind of plagiarism.
Like how in a God, you know, in the Garden of Eden, mm-hmm. it sounds like he's saying in a God of Davida. So, it'd be like if you wrote a song like, well, now that I know he's saying in the Garden of Eden, I'm going to write a song where someone says in a God of Davida. But I don't know what he could have heard that would make that where he thought they were saying, I can't drive 55.
Oh, yeah, the original.
Like, what did he actually say? What was the song? No, he is saying. Do you understand what I'm saying, Hagar said?
Yeah, totally.
So you can't take that and go like, well, that's how he must have come up with I Can't Drive
55. I've got a great example.
Or Mas Tequila.
You know
Tequila.
That song, I can't remember who the original artist is, but Stuck in Lodi Again?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Creedence.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. For many years, decades, I thought that they were saying only the good die young. There's a similar song, similar lyrics, and it sounds a little
so strange. That's how they came up with that song, Only the Good Die Young. That's how Billy Joel came up with that?
Maybe.
I thought Towns Van Zandt penned
he
Stuck
might
in
have.
Lodi.
He yeah, might have.
Not Creedence.
Dude, he wrote every song.
Unbeknownst to a lot of people.
Yeah. He wrote all the songs.
Yeah. Tragic.
Okay. Him and J.J. Cale.
Can I move on to this Fisher research out of Maine?
There's a good Please. One.
Everybody knows what a Fisher is. So it's a member of the weasel family, a mustelid, like a souped up pine marten, which mm-hmm. is like a souped up weasel. They're doing some lynx research in Maine, and they're finding that, and this is bizarre, they're finding that Fishers successfully prey on lynx.
Wow.
Wow. That's awesome.
Because they have lynx with, they have collared lynx. And what people do when they're doing mortality studies is you put a collar on a thing that like logs a GPS waypoint every whatever. I don't know what's typical in a mortality study, but it logs a GPS waypoint every X hours. And then all of a sudden you see that thing doesn't move for an unusual period of time. And then you go there quickly and try to ascertain what's going on. They're doing the lynx work in the winter, so there's snow on the ground, so you can get a pretty vivid picture of what happened. And Fishers seem to get on their trail and track them. And they even mentioned in this thing that it seems that during snow flurries, during snowstorms, they will make their move and jump on the lynx and kill it by biting the back of its neck. Now, this should also be known about Fishers is there's some bad mofos because they're one of the few things that really regularly kills porcupines. They get them rolled over and attack the soft, quill-less belly patch.
Pine martens do too, right?
I don't know about pine martens.
I heard that. They're cousins.
Yeah. Guy wrote in about Mark Kenyon was on this show and he's talking about eating apples. How you can eat apples to mask your the scent that you breathe out. I don't know if that works. Now, I remember hearing the same thing about carrots. Like, eat a bunch of apples, then you smell like something deer would want to eat. There's a guy who was saying one of the upsides, and he acknowledged the many downsides, one of the upsides of being a chaw dog is that when he's up in his tree spitting out chew spit, he's had deer come up and lick up that dip.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa.
Ooh. You don't buy that?
No, it's going to get people chewing.
Yeah, a guy wrote in that we talk about chew too much and it's going to make, and we've had a couple people write in and say that us talking about chew made them start dipping again.
Relapse.
He pulled into a gas station and bought a tin.
Well,
and another guy said that we're talking about dip. And I feel like when I'm talking about dip, I'm talking about people getting cancer and riddled with holes in their face. But he said we're going to make kids start dipping if we don't stop talking about dip. So I hesitate to talk about the deer attractant qualities of
but
dip.
But the one thing that we're missing there is that you don't have to catalyze dip to have a smell by putting it in your mouth. You just bring an extra Yeti just and dump a can in there, some hot water, and then dump it around your tree stand. Like, it doesn't have to touch your body.
That's a good point. Come you on. Just buy a log.
Yeah.
Have a thermos.
Yeah, just dribble it the whole way out, you know. Cancer free.
Or just have Garrett just put the lid on a bunch of his Gatorade bottles.
Yes. Sell them.
Ooh. Save them. Yeah.
Yeah, you're going eBay. To a sporting goods store and it'll be next to the Doan Rut urine is just a bottle of Doug Durin. It should be Doug Durin's piss and Dirt's chew spit.
Dirt's spit.
Or you make a concoction of Buckman juice and Dirt Myth spit.
With some apple.
That'd be a great product, man. It was Doug Durin's urine mixed with Dirt's chew spit, and it's like a deer, it'd be like the world's greatest deer attractant.
You can just call it Rut.
Okay, one more quick thing. I did my correction. I talked about deer licking up dip. Talked about fishers. I'm going to touch on New Zealand, which is a kind of baffling situation. And no one here is going to have an expert opinion on that. And another thing, guy was talking about Seth, right? You were just sharing with us recently about shot gobbling turkeys by throwing rocks at stop signs.
Yep.
Okay, guy hunts in upstate New York, and he says the most beautiful shot gobbling that occurs is he hunts by a lake that has a lot of loons.
Oh.
And in the spring, a loon will light up, and it'll shot gobble turkeys.
That's one I have not heard before.
Yep.
Add it to the list.
Who can do a loon call?
That's tough.
Ooh, that was pretty good.
Not bad.
Okay, New Zealand. Now, this is just telling. I'll just tell this. I can't put any. There's nothing I can do here for you. I'm providing nothing but just telling about. This is outside of my area of expertise. I'm deeply American, but just as like game management in Africa baffles me, game management in New Zealand baffles me. But there's a debate going on where, like in New Zealand, the sort of radical left of the environmental movement is very anti game animals because there's no game animals native to New Zealand. They had those big 500-pound birds, but they killed them all. Prior, I think they were
moas.
Yeah, but I think they were extinct prior to
colonialism.
European contact, like the indigenous people. I think once it was settled by, you know, what became the indigenous population, those birds were wiped out. But when Europeans started showing up, they started trucking over all the game animals they were familiar with from Europe and also Asia, and even some from North America because they put some elk here and there. But and they brought tar over, Himalayan tar, and cut them loose in New Zealand. And they occupy the alpine areas of New Zealand and apparently cause some amount of damage to native flora. So the hunters want all the game animals. They like to hunt for them. And the left side of the environmental spectrum would like to see them eradicated. And right now, there was like some really aggressive coal was proposed. And typically when they go in coal tar in New Zealand, so the government shoots them out of helicopters. The reason you see so much crazy stuff happen in New Zealand, it would never go on here. Like, you know, landing helicopters next to animals and killing them and having year-round hunting with no bag limits. It's all because it's non-native. It's all non-native wildlife that isn't particularly welcome in a lot of places. But when the government guys are up shooting them out of helicopters, a lot of times they'll just shoot the females and they'll leave bulls so guys can go hunt them. But someone came up with this really aggressive coal plan, which would have, you know, I guess once and for all, put the finishing touches on a number of these populations of tar. And the hunters got all mad. We had a lot of hunters from New Zealand writing into us saying, hey, man, you should speak up on this. But I can't really speak up on it with real authority because I don't really understand. But I know that when I'm like, oftentimes you'll see hunters in New Zealand and Australia kind of be like, hey, hunting here is good or hunting here is okay because it's all non-natives anyways. And we got to get rid of the non-natives. So it puts you in a weird situation if you've been articulating that perspective. And all of a sudden now you're like, whoa, wait a minute. Don't kill them all, right? It's a weird situation.
What was the aggressive plan the like liberal left or whatnot came up with?
Oh, it was killing hundreds of thousands of tar and shooting all the bulls.
Yeah.
And you have to assume it's probably like flavored with a little bit of anti-hunting sentiment. the way it's presented to me. Because they used to leave bulls around because without females, they're not doing a lot to explode the population. And then hunters could go hunt the bulls.
Yeah.
And, you know, whatever. Get the hides, eat the meat. I hunted tar in New Zealand. This is probably one of the more dangerous hunts I've ever been on. What's your take on it, man?
My take is I remember visiting.
You mind introducing yourself?
Oh, this is Eduardo Garcia, everybody. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Yeah. So having never been to New Zealand, I still think that anybody who lives on this earth can have some type of perspective, and it's just based on where you've been in life. So my perspective on the non-native species goes back to a trip I took in my early 20s when I was working as a yacht chef. So we were on a boat out of San Diego, and we went to an island called Guadalupe Island, which is southwest of San Diego, in the Pacific Ocean. And it's not a huge island, but let's call it 15 miles in length and maybe 4 miles in its most widest part. And it just comes straight up out of the Pacific. So super deep blue water right offshore. We were going there to fish for tuna and to check out the great whites that literally just troll the perimeter. It's part of a triangle of migration between San Francisco, Guadalupe, and Hawaii for great whites in Pacific.
And what are the great whites feeding on?
They're feeding on seals. They're feeding on seals. Yeah, it's a pretty sketchy kayak ride into shore. They're feeding on seals. They're and then if you're fishing like we were, you know, you're ending up with tons of carcasses. And so a good time is to just wrap a line on a yellowtail tuna or yellowfin tuna's tail, and you'll have 18-footers, 15-footers just cruising.
Oh, like after you cut the meat out, just hang the carcass?
Yeah, you'll have a cooler, and you just open the drain a little bit and have a carcass in there and just be dribbling blood into your, you know, behind when you're swinging on anchor.
Oh yeah.
So that's what we're there for, you know, with the boss fishing. And but when we also went hiking on the island, and this island was mostly denuded. There was very little trees. There was very little flora and fauna, and there was skulls and live goats. So dead and live domestic goats all over the island. And what I learned was that whalers back in time of yore had dropped these goats off on their way out to the like Easter Islands and explorations of the Pacific, and they used a few of these islands, not just Guadalupe, but Cedros Islands and islands off of Baja, as these nurseries for food on the return trip. They would be returning lean, and then they would be able to harvest these goats that had just been living happy and fat on this island, right? But the population exploded, and they literally ate everything on the island to the point where the Mexican government came in and culled most of these goats back.
Got you.
But like the red-breasted robin, or I think it's even there's an indigenous bird to that zone called the Guadalupe robin, similar to our American red-breasted robin, that almost went extinct. And so that my take on it is that like a place was built to be a certain way, and as soon as we start screwing with Mother Nature, we're done. Like there is absolutely no way to catch back up. In what I've seen.
Let me give you a 2-point counter.
Yeah.
In the case of New Zealand, so many of the things that were like, so many of the native species were eradicated, you know, well, driven to extinction or extirpated.
Yeah.
So you've already kind of got, I think that sort of provided a motivation to repopulate it.
Right.
So there's that. And that, I'm not saying that's the final word on it, but you have to like imagine. Right. It's not like you're like supplementing an existing thing. You kind of have this like people went to this place where you expect like a large landmass to have large mammals.
Right.
And even though there weren't large mammals there, there was these like large birds there. And so people probably felt an absence.
Sure.
You know, so there's that. A quick note on how the whalers used to stock islands all over.
Yeah.
Did you hear about the whalers that used to go and get, they'd stop by and get giant tortoises? In a variety of places, like you know, everywhere. Even people would stop into the Seychelles later and get giant tortoises off there, and they'd go to other areas and get them. They liked them because you could flip them over.
Yeah.
Put them in the hold of the boat, flipped over, and they would stay alive for months.
Jeez.
You want to talk about humane slaughter practices?
Oh, my God.
The second counter is this, and this is an interesting perspective on non-natives, where the Hawaiian Islands weren't colonized until around 1,100 years ago. So seafaring Polynesians discovered, kind of in a truer sense of the word, being like the first people to discover the Hawaiian Islands 1,100 years ago. And they introduced, and that they quickly introduced dogs, rats, probably accidentally, pigs, okay, and a wide array of edible fruits. So like Hawaii didn't have mango and papaya and pineapple and breadfruit. This is all stuff that was cultivated.
Sure.
So I was hunting in Molokai with some native Hawaiians, and the Nature Conservancy had recently bought up some large properties. And the Nature Conservancy was pushing an idea that they wanted to eradicate the wild pigs off of the land because they wanted to do a non-native eradication. The Hawaiians articulated a perspective to me that we're indigenous people. We're native people. We've been here for however long we've been here. The entire time that we've been here with pigs. How can I be native, but the pig be non-native? And they said, if we really wanted to get serious about eradicating non-natives, I would be looking toward you folks rather than these pigs. So the point being, I think people get pretty used to, like, people get pretty used to having the animals around that they have. And to these boys in New Zealand who've been writing in, it's a really insulting idea that you would wipe out their resource.
I get it.
But again, man, I don't really know. I don't really know the answer.
It's like Texas.
You want to introduce yourself?
Hey, I'm Danielle Pruitt.
Okay. Texas?
Yeah, I live in Texas. And it's sort of the same thing there. A lot of non-natives. You want to eradicate some of that. But then again, you have all these outfitters that profit off of it. So it's like that constant battle between the two ideas of what do you do with this problem we have? And then the people who are banking in on it, cashing in, actually raise, like keeping and trapping pigs and letting them go.
Yeah.
It's a catch 22.
For sure.
And yeah, the pigs, they get a bad rap because they, you know, they can be destructive, right? But it's really, it is different in this way than a rainbow trout and a brown trout because, I don't know, there is some competition in the native rivers, right, with the native fish.
Yeah, but it's generally not, like brown trout generally aren't causing trouble.
No, not that we know of. I think that they know that there is some competition in our rivers with native fish and the introduced trout, right? But
yeah, it's
if
not
you
helping.
All of a sudden made a campaign to call out all rainbow and brown trout out of the Rocky Mountain states, get a little pushback.
But you know what? I would be in a position to be consistent. If someone proposed that, to be consistent, I don't know, man. I was going to say to be consistent, I would support it. Just to have the clarity.
But you see, one of the things that I believe is that there, our moral and ethical compass needs to migrate and mature with, it needs to evolve with everything else. And just because it's kind of an easy thing for us to say, yeah, like, let's bring it back to its like original holistic way. I struggle to believe that is actually attainable in some scenarios.
Sure.
I don't believe currently. It is at all.
There you go. And so what it means, though, is that we have to shift, like, it's a paradigm shift needs to happen. We need to shift our perspective as to, okay, well, what is the new normal? And, you know, some of these things are here to stay. You know, how do we do, how do we continue to be stewards while getting the fuck out of the way and just letting Mother Nature like cull also and figure it out, you know? Like a friend was talking to me about mountain lion hunting here in Montana last week. And he was saying, you know what I want to do? He said, I think we need to shoot female mountain lions. right?
For what purpose?
In his mind, it's part of game management. Is predator?
Like he wants to see fewer lions.
He's watching all I'm living in Southwest Montana, where the predator population is robust and growing.
Yeah,
right. Grizzly bears, wolves, mountain lions, you name it.
That being not even a debatable point.
No,
I want to clarify for people. Yeah. This isn't like a debatable.
It's just
point.
By the numbers.
Yeah,
you know, and so his point is like, hey, we need to. And he was just talking about mountain lions, and I'm just sharing a conversation that happened.
Sure, man.
That
yeah.
he's like, you know what? My point of view is I want to harvest female mountain lions. Eliminates the next generation just right off the bat. And if we have a few more toms out there, the toms naturally will be culling their own kin to keep their own population down. That's what Mother Nature has instilled in them to do, you know?
And, yeah, they practice fratricide.
There you go.
Yeah.
And so he's in his way, he was just saying, like, I'm going to mediate a little bit just to kind of let Mother Nature take back over a little bit.
Yeah.
Which was interesting. I didn't have much to debate there. I was just listening to him saying, yeah, all right, I hear you. You know, are you going to eat it? That was my next question. Are you going to eat it? And he's one of those. He's a little on the fence with, you know, the things he does and doesn't eat from the wild. But I was like, well, fuck it. Give it to me. I'll eat it, you know.
Yeah, it's pretty good, man.
I've heard it tastes like pig.
No, I like it. Yeah, I like it. Yeah. None of this is what we're supposed to be talking about. Is everybody cool on the things we brought up so far?
No, that was the perfect segue. I can't believe
did I miss a good segue?
Yeah. Yeah, Eduardo just served it up, man.
Do you mind taking it and running since I missed it?
Yeah. Speaking of eating mountain lions.
Oh, no, because I wanted to segue into the tongue.
Oh.
So I got to go back. I got to go. Here, check out this one. Here's the segue for you. Hey, remember when I was talking earlier about 1996?
Mm-hmm. The right? Tongue?
Yeah. Well, here's why. That was when wasn't 96. We cooked tongue in 94. First time. 1994. I had moved away from home and was living with my brother Danny and our buddies Brian and Matt Drost. And we lived in a house. I remember my rent was $110 a month. But also a part of the house was actually falling away from the other part of the house. Where you
sacrifices,
like, you could run an extension cord from inside to out without opening a door or window. Honestly. And like I remember the shower leaked so bad and the landlord wouldn't come over there that we went and bought a gallon of roofing tar and roofing tarred our shower. And roofing tar takes forever to dry in a shower. So you know when you set your shampoo bottle down, it'd get like roofing tar on it. So the every ledge has a roofing tar ring on it because it just took months for that roofing tar to set up. That kind of place. And we were eating a lot of deer meat, and we were eating every part of it. We were just eating everything we could get our hands on. We
dirt ate bagging.
Yeah, we ate four deer between the opening of bow season, October 1st. We ate four deer between the opening of bow season and the beginning of Christmas break, which started like December 10th. And we always knew that people could eat tongues. I was telling Danielle about this yesterday. And we would, I remember one night we were partying and took a deer tongue and just boiled a pot for a long time and just couldn't get it figured out. I didn't know about the skin thing. Right? Did you guys get that?
Yeah.
And we kind of decided, we sort of put that whole idea on ice for a long time. But I'll point out that it also took us many years to figure out what was up with beaver tails. It took a long time to be like, oh, so that's what they're talking about when they talk about beaver tails.
It's all fat inside?
Mm-hmm. It's like steak gristle inside there.
I wonder if you could just render that somehow.
Oh, yeah.
Trying to
you could render it.
Gnaw on it. Eat
you
it.
Could render it out for sure. So there's that. So Danielle, talk about how you cook up deer tongue. And then I want Eduardo to talk about tongue.
Well, we were talking about this yesterday. And for people who look at it as this terrifying alien-looking thing, imagine that it's sort of like a little pot roast that is enclosed in a hard rubber case. So all you'd have to do, no matter pretty much, I think any tongue recipe is always started the same way. boiling, braising in some sort of liquid to tenderize, cook the meat on the inside, and you're also separating the skin from the meat. And then when you plunge it in that ice bath, that cold water shocks meat, it contracts, and then you have a little bit of separation to help you peel it. And from that point, you have like endless options. It's like a piece of meat. I was thinking about doing some sort of pot roast, cut it into big hunks, add it to carrots, potatoes, whatever, some stock, and what, just put it back in the oven for a while until all the vegetables are cooked, and it's like a pot roast. But I think there's a lot of things you can do. You haven't tried that yet? I have not tried that yet. I have a lot of ideas.
I used to always tell people that it wasn't worth messing with any tongue up until you got into like elk.
Mm-hmm.
But I now realize that that's like not at all correct.
Yeah.
Because that deer tongue we did yesterday, just a regular old deer tongue.
Makes a lot of...
Yeah. It makes a really... Like a, mm-hmm. like a, definitely like a meal for someone or an appetizer for 6 to 8 people.
Yeah. And I think that's the nice thing about if you've got one tongue and you want to have people over, have a dinner party and really share something different that most people have never experienced, having that sliced up and seared. I think whatever you do after you braise it, having some sort of hard sear after, either on a grill or in a hot saute pan, adds a lot, helps enhance that texture a little bit. Some coloration is really big, but...
Because it can get kind of a weird look to them.
Yeah, it's like that grayish color. And to me, that's sort of the first thing I see. I say it all the time, you eat with your eyes first. You see a meal, if it looks like shit, you've got it in your head that you're not going to like it. So I always find some way to add some sort of coloration to that meat. So
have you ever just cured them?
No, I haven't.
Because when I first started getting better at preparing them, it was because I hung out with a buddy of mine who's a chef and had like an actual restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to do a lot of tongue dishes in his restaurant. He was Jewish, so he's got, you know, like a we're discussing this as well. Like Hispanic culture, Basque culture, you know, there's a bunch of cultures around the world that like utilize tongue and have like tongue traditions. But then Jewish delis, it's a mm-hmm. very common dish in like large Eastern cities. Yeah, Jewish delis have tongue sandwich. So he came from it from that perspective, but was also very big into charcuterie.
Mm-hmm.
He would take like a dozen veal tongues and do them all at once. And he would put them in a dry brine, skin on, and cure them
mm-hmm.
with pink salt.
Mm-hmm.
So then when you braise them, pull the skin, then he'd smoke them.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be that pink salt would turn it like a beautiful, beautiful red.
Didn't you do that on a...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I've done that.
Yeah.
Lots of times.
I remember seeing that.
Yeah. So that's how he would conquer the color problem. And it would also make it that when... You know, I think you should ought to do first is just like really quickly walk through the steps of like just how you cooked the deer tongue yesterday.
Yesterday's, so we braised it. You braised it in a little pot.
Probably 3 hours.
That wasn't just water. Did you add
stock?
Okay, it was stock. So I like to think that whatever you're braising it in imparts some flavor. So some sort of flavoring.
I would have just done water. Because I don't think it really matters, probably.
I don't know if it would either.
But I did stop because I didn't want you to look down on me.
Well, and I told you, I never, ever, ever tell anybody to use like a bouillon cube. I hate those.
Well,
only time I would ever do that is because I have not yet tested side-by-side braised in water, braised in stock. If that meat, peel it and you were to take a slice right then. I haven't tested that yet.
Blind testing?
Yeah, because I don't know how much you can actually penetrate and like flavor the meat the way you normally would flavor meat in stock with that shell over.
Yeah, but I knew you were going to season it, and I knew you were going to make an accompaniment.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think if you're like, yeah, if you were just going to be like, no, I'm just going to boil it, like in the old days, like they used to do out on the Great Plains, shoot a buffalo, cut its tongue out, boil it, slice it up, eat it, then I would want to boil it in the salted stock.
Right.
Right. But since you're going to do all that other junk, I would have just done it water, but I didn't want you to come over to my house and think that I was a shitty cook. So I put stock in there.
I told you not to use your good stock, though. Yeah. I did say that. Yeah, and I think you can braise it stovetop, put a lid on it, low. Pressure cookers are awesome tools to use if you're...
But man, you got to be careful with pressure cookers.
What do you mean?
Because you can't monitor it.
So I am a fan of manual pressure cookers and the newer ones.
What you're supposed to be doing, if I would allow you to do
sorry,
it.
I'm sorry, am I off
like,
track?
Yeah, just march us through like bam, 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 you did yesterday.
Okay. So we braised the tongue until it was tender. And you could tell we stuck a fork, like one of the spokes of the fork, and you could tell that you could just sort of slide it under the skin, and you knew the meat was tender after about 3.5 hours. So we pulled it out, gave it an ice bath, peeled it, which took a little bit of time. And
yeah, you're kind of peeling and kind of using a paring knife.
Yeah, so you don't want to cut through the meat. And so I used a paring knife, I think a super sharp fillet knife that's really thin and flexible would also help just to sort of, kind of like you're getting silver skin
off. Who sharpened that knife?
You sharpened it.
Oh, that's right. It's very sharp. Go on.
Yeah, because it always seems like with those tongs, man, you get like half of it that just comes right off, and then the other, there's different like binding materials between the skin and the meat in different locations on that tongue.
And there's definitely...
Can I butt in for a minute?
Uh-huh.
Rich Pound, are you cool? You haven't said a thing all day.
Well, I got a question. I do.
Because she's marching through the steps.
I know. And I do have a question. I'm glad you asked, because I was trying to find my moment, but... is it safe to say that, like, for the domestic chef and, like, people cooking at home, that if you get a tongue, like, the best thing to do is to just baseline, just braise it first and then get creative? You have to do...
I wouldn't worry about dry brining it ahead of time and all that. If you just want to be like, what's this all about? If you want to be, what's this about? I would make the thing that she's talking about.
Yeah. That was really good.
Because the chef buddy that does the dry brine... the peel, the smoking, that's some labor-intensive shit.
Yeah.
But the thing is, he's doing a dozen of them, and these are beef tongues.
They're bigger.
So he's doing like, he's making a day out of it. You know what I mean?
The ROI is really there.
The return on investment.
Where are people finding Danielle's recipe?
Oh.
Good question.
We're going to put it out in a video.
Oh, nice. Cool. I look forward to seeing that.
Yeah.
Go on. March through. You good, Chris?
Yeah. But so if you got a tongue, like say you shot your first deer, you cut the tongue out, you're like, oh, I'm going to do something with this. You don't want to stick it in the oven. You don't want to put it in a slow cooker. You want to braise it first, right?
Well, a slow cooker would work fine.
Yeah.
It would?
Same thing.
Do the same thing.
Same thing. Okay. Cover it in liquid.
Cover it in liquid.
You good, Seth? You ever cook a tongue?
I have not, but I do have some in the freezer.
Oh, good.
And it's like, I look at them, it's like, man, I don't know what to do with that thing.
No, hang on. They last forever.
They do. That was my question. How long they last in the freezer?
You got that protective sheath on them.
Yeah.
All humans will be dead as long as there's a freezer running somewhere. the tongue will be fine, man. Some future species will cook that tongue up. Okay. March is through.
Okay. So, yeah. I start every process with the same, braising it. And then peel it. So, it's a lot easier to peel if you've cooked it first, and then being super patient, you don't want to try to cut the meat and this, you don't want to like cut the meat thinking you're just going to peel it that way. You want to like sort of wiggle that knife in between. I think the same way you sort of start getting silver skin off of meat, and then use your fingers and you can start to peel. Sometimes it doesn't work so easily, and then you just have to be patient. But so once I got it peeled, then
the skin is like, don't worry. The skin is extremely obvious. There's no question about what it is you're trying to get off.
Yeah, you're not like, is that meat? Is that skin? It's like, it's also bumpy. It's hard. It's gross.
So do you peel it because of like, it's just tougher than hell?
Oh, yeah.
Or,
you know,
I mean, it's like just eating the plastic, I would imagine. I don't know what, or rubber.
Yeah.
You can try it. Let me know how it goes.
We could have given you a whole handful of it yesterday. Yeah. Make a little skin.
I didn't know you were curious about this.
I didn't know
if it was
just like an appearance texture thing.
That I think the texture matters. So it's like at the very back of the tongue, there's like always that that hump. I don't know the correct term for that. But there's always, once you peel like those big taste buds off, there's still like some raised bumps. So I'm, that textural things like that really bother me. So I take that paring knife and shave it kind of like you'd shave your face, so it's smooth, so you don't have any like bumpy textures.
You shave your face.
I don't know.
Set him up too easy for that, man.
If I had ever shaved my face, that's
exactly
what I would imagine. I should rephrase that.
Speaking to a group of guys saying,
no,
you
that's
guys
good.
Yeah. Should know.
She's being relatable.
Yeah.
Okay, so there you are. Tongue's all peeled up. You got the little bumpies. Yeah. You scrape the bumpies off.
Yeah. And then slice it. If I could slice it as super, super thin, I would have maybe wrapped it in plastic wrap, put it in the freezer, time willing, and that sort of hardens it up, and then you can really get nice thin slices. But when it's sort of just fresh out of that ice bath, it's still a really firm texture. It's still really easy to cut through. So I sliced into about quarter inch, eighth inch.
No, man.
Quarter inch?
No, they're way thinner than quarter
they
inch.
They were thinner than that?
That knife was sharp.
That knife was so sharp.
Those were not quarter inch slices.
They were about eighth inch.
3/16.
I don't think they were that thin. But I'll take
it. Well, 4/16 is a quarter inch. What do you think, Yanni? You were there.
3/16 sounds good.
Okay.
Maybe even a hair less. Go ahead. Real thin.
So then I made a nice little spice mix that had some smoked paprika in it. So a really nice bright red color. So once you mix that and season the meat with that rub, then you finally got a little red color to that gray meat, which
and
is...
that made that shit come alive, man.
And that's when you go from like, this is tongue, this is meat. It's like kind of hopping that bridge that people need mentally to get over from
yeah,
like
once
animal
that color,
to food.
Once that hit, it was
yeah,
it was ready. It was yeah. It was looking good.
Yeah. So then the last step was hot saute pan, a little bit of oil, sear it on both sides, and I always use a little spatula to press it down, because a lot of times meat that pressure, they like to sort of dome up, and then the circle doesn't get seared, only the ring on the outside edge. So I just flatten it down one by one, flip it over, do it to the other side, and you're done.
And it was, no, you drizzled it with something.
Chimichurri.
This is some good high grade. This is advanced wild game cooking. That shit was good. Real good.
It was really good, but it seems so simple. Like
it is.
Advanced but simple. You
yeah.
know? Advanced
because
it was so
good. Approachable
for
yeah. people. Like if you're at home, you're like, you're not like looking at 100 steps. It's like, oh, it's that easy. Braise it, peel it,
yeah.
slice it, sear it. Ta-da.
Chris, what made it advanced in your mind versus simple? What about the complete tongue recipe?
I think the one, like knowing like what to do with like the presentation because of the gray color, like being like, oh, we need to add some spice to this, one, for flavor, and two, to make it like appetizing to look at. And then two, like knowing things like the doming and like flattening, like that's a little more advanced. Like I wouldn't know how to do that, but simple in the way that like I'm not a good cook, but watching you cook the whole thing, it was like, oh, I could probably do that.
Yeah.
If I had like a walkthrough.
Yeah.
You could set Chris's baseline by having you share your famous gray rabbit recipe.
Oh, man.
And that would give everybody a good baseline of where Chris is coming from in his culinary experience.
Yeah, I cooked some gray rabbit. It wasn't good.
It was gray and in species.
No one really understands the story.
Yeah. Dude, I don't really even understand
so
it.
It's not just me?
No.
It was okay. A cottontail rabbit.
It was a swamp rabbit. Same as a cottontail?
Yeah. What's the Sylvalagus aquaticus? It's a 6 pound. It's a cottontail that grows to 5-6 pounds.
It was a big one.
Sounds swamp. Like a nightmare.
Yeah.
Dude, yeah, but these are cool rabbits.
Delicious.
Man. The coolest thing about these rabbits. You know how a normal cottontail just shits wherever he pleases? A swamp rabbit has a log.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
They got like a defecation log where they got a little spot where they presumably like they like to use it because they can get up and look around and get up out of the water when it's wet. These rabbits will swim away from you. They'll jump in the Mississippi or the Ohio and swim across the river.
That's amazing.
Wow. And they live out in the marsh. 5-pound rabbits.
My dog would love that rabbit.
And they got a little log where they like to go. It's like llamas. Llamas will have pick a spot and shit in a spot.
Uh-huh.
And make like a little hill. And then they'll actually climb up on the hill.
Yeah.
After many months of building it up.
Yeah.
And use it as a place to get a look around.
It's pretty smart.
It's like a prairie dog thing.
That's like the
shit.
ultimate recycling of materials. They're like, not only is it food, but it's also function.
Yes.
So closed loop, man.
So they have a defecation log. And Chris took some. It's very good. It's very good to eat. And he took some, and he sucks at cooking. Not sucks at cooking. Sucks at cooking game. By your admission.
I'd say sucks at cooking.
Okay. Flat out sucks at cooking.
Yeah. The game doesn't help because it just adds like another level of like carefulness.
Tried to prepare the rabbit for a lady who he was, you know, trying to impress. It came out gray. No one was happy. He felt that he'd set everything back.
Tell us the recipe, the procedure.
I forgot. I think it was a recipe in one of the small game book.
Don't you dare.
But here's where I messed up. I think.
Come on.
I think. The taste wasn't bad. It was just the color. And I think the issue was like I just didn't brown it enough before. Because I think it calls for browning and then you bake it. Mm. Right? Maybe. But anyways, the browning, I think that was my fatal misstep. Was like,
mm-hmm.
I was just worried about burning it the whole time.
And that's the perfect segue because that's exactly what Danielle was just talking about, was like making food appetizing to the eyes first. And you didn't pour it
off.
That
was rule number one. And then nobody was like,
mm. I wish I would have been there for this meal, man.
Would have been, yeah.
A fly on the wall or more like Steve or more like Chris's chef that was there to
No. Fly on the wall. Moving on. You good? We beat you up about this a bunch of times. Like, because we don't know what happened. The reason I'm moving on is there's no lesson.
There's no lesson.
Like, if I was there, if someone would have been there, I would have said, like, that's actually looks great. There's not a problem.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Did it look bad or did it also taste bad?
No, it tasted. I mean, it wasn't like probably amazing, but it was edible for sure.
Flavor was good.
Flavor was there.
Was it tender?
It was a little. It was not as tender as I'd hoped. It
could have gone for another 30 minutes.
Yeah, the tenderness was. Yeah, that was a little bit of an issue. And then the gray, the color was the worst part. That was.
Eduardo, do you mind? Can you jump in and give some perspective on tongue? Because I'm guessing that you didn't discover tongue when you were 20.
I actually discovered tongue when I was 18.
Oh.
Yeah, only because I was in culinary school. So,
oh, that's how you found out about it.
Yeah. So
it wasn't from, it wasn't like a family thing from having family from Mexico?
Well, it could have been.
Was it the wrong part of Mexico?
No, you're right on many levels except for it could have had tongue really from my mom's side, which is Russian Jewish from the East Coast, New Yorker. So that easily could have brought tongue into our life, and from my dad's the Latino edge. But no, I was raised sort of in more of a natural culture. I was raised on like tofu and miso soup and not a lot of game, not a lot of wild, not a lot of proteins.
Really?
Meat-based proteins. Yeah, more vegetarian, macrobiotic cooking, which is whole plant cooking.
What about fish?
Fish was expensive, so trout. Yeah, if the twin bro and I caught trout, we'd eat trout.
Gotcha.
And I guess when I was like in my teens, we started hunting. So we were like, Mom, we're eating game. Donk, you know, brought like a deer leg home.
Yeah.
But so tongue for me, cooking school, was the intro to methodology. And through methodology, when we talk about cooking, methodology required a diverse range of muscle cuts that require different cooking methods in order to have a tender brown, not gray rabbit, etc. You know, so my take on tongue was that was my first experience it, and then traveling around the world, you see it on all kinds of menus. It's really the U.S. has one of the most limited animal-based protein availability, kind of, you know, like available options out there. You go to Europe and they're eating turkey every single day, not just on Thanksgiving. Well, that's our holiday, but, you know, not just in the fall.
Yeah.
So I've seen and cooked tongue a bit. And I, you know, I think it is interesting, especially, I mean, heck, I think you have a recipe out there for like duck tongues. You cooked duck tongues before?
Nope, not me.
Really?
So people do. People are cooking duck tongues. I mean, yeah. that's a bite.
I've been served it, but I haven't prepared it.
Yeah. So tongue. This is how. So here's my thing on.
Hold on, I can't let duck tongues go. Like for real?
It's like a crispy duck tongue.
It's popular in Asian cultures. Right?
More like wok fried and then tossed in a sauce kind of a thing. So imagine eating like a popcorn shrimp, maybe not as tender, but there's going to be a little chew in there.
Are they peeling those too?
I don't think so.
Mm-mm. I haven't prepared them.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. We're going to be trying it.
Well, duck hunting season's coming up, so I'll sign up right now for that trip. That'll be fun.
Yeah, man. We'll discard the rest of the carcass and just pull a bunch of duck tongues.
There's a handful. I got like a running list of shit I want to mess with that I haven't messed with yet. And so, you know, have you ever been to like a dim sum place and eaten the gelled chicken feet?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, I haven't, you know, I want to get around to replicating that with turkey feet, grouse feet.
Feet are great. So feet. We're bouncing around a little bit, but the best chicken foot recipe I ever had was made by a Jamaican lady, and she would use the feet. It's what I do now. I make all of my chicken stock out of chicken feet, so it's because it's loaded with all of the tendons.
You raise up chickens, don't you?
I raise chickens, not enough to cull butcher myself. I just buy pounds of frozen chicken feet from a butcher or grocery store. And the reason I use those for chicken stock is because per square pound, I guess, or however you want to, equate that, a foot has the most connective tissue and ligaments and cartilage and joint matter, which is packed with collagen. And collagen, when cooked down, turns into gelatin, which creates your beautiful viscous broths and stocks that have mouthfeel and stuff. So pound for pound and dollar for pound, it's like the most economical way to have the best tasting stocks out there is go for the shins, the hooves, the feet, the tail, right? If you're hunting animal with tail.
I know you're worried about how far off track you are, and I know where you need to wind up.
Yeah.
Can I throw another thing in to ask you if you have any familiarity with this?
Sure.
You're familiar with bird's nest soup?
Yes.
Okay, so there's a type of swallow, a cliff-dwelling swallow. I'm not talking to you, I'm talking to the listener. There's a cliff-dwelling swallow that produces a spit that has a glue-like quality to it. And they take nesting materials, coat it with this spit, and then build their nest. And bird's nest soup, it's a thing that people do too. You basically take this thing and simmer it and extract that viscous liquid from it. And it's used to make like a somewhat viscous consomme. I took cliff swallows, you know, the mud ones, the mud nests that you see here under bridges and stuff. I took a bunch of those and bashed them up and boiled them for a long time and then let the dirt settle and strained it off and reduced that down. And I could never find what I was after. Like I could never get like that spit.
Yeah.
That viscous spit.
Different type of swallow.
Yeah. But go on. Tongues.
Tongues. What are we talking about? Sort of what's my take or what's my, I think it's a muscle worth eating. I think it's ridiculous. If you look at the commercial industry, the commercial industry wastes very little because everything's got value to it.
I messed you up. That's not where you were.
Where was I?
Feet.
Oh, well, would
a turkey foot work?
For
have
stock?
Have you done with a wild turkey?
No, I haven't.
There's no reason.
Yeah, I don't know why.
Of course you could.
I save my geese feet for stock.
You do?
Yeah.
Snow
you
gotta geese clean feet?
It. Yeah, Canada's. So their feet are pretty nasty. So I always wash them clean, potato scrubber, scrub them off, and then I blanch it in boiling water in case there's anything bacteria-wise on it because you don't want all that inside of your stock. So, yeah, I blanch them, scrub them, and then knife, start to break them at the joints to sort of open them up, and then I throw them in the stock.
No shit.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Almost every part of the animal, I mean, could be simmered down to a flavored broth. There's no reason why not to, you know? Yeah.
Okay, now go.
On tongues?
Yeah.
Yeah. For tongue, for me, it's I enjoy it a few different ways. The way Danielle's recipe shares, which is slow cooked until it's tender, peeled, and then browned off. Right? Do I have that right? And seasoned. I like it that way. I also like it more as a deli meat as well. So slow cooked until tender, peeled, and then left whole. And so I'll cook a tongue, peel it back, and then once it's at that tender place, I'll just refreeze it again and just label it cooked tongue. And at that point, it's ready for kind of a array of possibilities. You could...
Do you mess with deer tongues too, or just bigger ones?
But I usually just mess with the bigger ones as of yet. Yeah. For, I have a very limited time in my day-to-day, and the ROI comment earlier, it's kind of bang for your buck, like an elk tongue or a cow tongue, just has more bang for your buck. I'll go down. They harvest bison on the park line here in southwest Montana as part of a indigenous hunting opportunity for native tribes from the Pacific Northwest to come in and hunt bison that are coming out of Yellowstone Park. And I'll often go down during that time of year and pick up heart and kidney and call fat and tongue if they don't want them. Because, I mean, that's major bang for your buck.
That's a good idea.
Freaking huge. Well, you know. But so I'll keep a cooked tongue in the freezer. And at that point, I'll thaw it out and slack it. And then just slice it quarter
inch. What's slack it mean?
Slack it means is a restaurant term when you pull something out of the freezer and let it thaw slowly. Right, so you would pull something and put it on the tray and throw it in the fridge for a couple of days and let it slack or thaw out, and gotcha. Or put it on your counter. I always felt like when you dump a frozen something because you're stressed and hustling, you don't have time, and you dump it in warm water, you're almost like stressing more water and moisture out of the meat, and you end up with a lot more coming out of it than when you just let it naturally thaw mm-hmm. on its own at room temp. But so when the tongue is then thawed, I'll just cut it. Like just quarter inch, just like you would a steak sandwich. And I'll throw it on a bagel with arugula or sprouts and onion and good mustard and mayo and what, and just make a sandwich out of it.
Now really?
It's, now like it's a cold that. Cut. Oh, yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. And it's interesting, right? So I have this thought a lot is that how often are folks eating meat without seasonings, without salt, without any herbs, without anything but the meat? Just like, and you know, like that's what rabbit tastes like. That's what antelope tastes like. That's what.
Rarely.
Rarely, right? And so oftentimes we're eating a combination of, it's like seeing something naked for the first time, you know, seeing to eat a meat, you know what I'm saying? It's like, yeah. Oh, that's what you look like, you know, but to eat something without any of the dressings. And it's a
never.
Yeah, never. And you should do it because then it starts the fundamental process of the education of, well, that's what it tastes like.
Yeah. No,
okay.
That's smart, man.
Now
for me,
I'm going to start laying.
Baseline is a little bit of salt. Like if I really bad, like what's this like? I still put a little bit of salt on it, but you're right. You should strip it down.
Well, boil pasta just for the easiest test. Just boil pasta in naked water and boil pasta in salted water. And it's not so much that you're tasting the salt. If it's salted appropriately, is salt dehydrates. So salt pulls out natural flavors in the form of dehydration. It's pulling out moisture from anything. You put salt on an apple, you're gonna see liquid come up, and that's natural. That's the moisture that's within that organic matter, right? And so salting is kind of fundamental to pulling natural flavor out. You can oversalt, and that's a bad deal too. So that's one way. I like to cold slice a tongue. And then another one that I want to mess with more is slow cooking it till it's tender and then slicing it and then frying it. So you're still trying to brown it, but I'll shallow fry it in a cast iron full of lard, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe dredge it a little bit too. So take that cold sliced tongue, season it with some salt and pepper, if you will, flour, and then fry it. And now all of a sudden you have this crispy little like chicken fried steak thing happening. And that's pretty sweet.
Yeah, I've been wanting to do the same thing because then it reminds me of calamari almost.
Yeah. Yeah.
That soft texture, crispy exterior.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever sous vide tongue?
I haven't.
I haven't mm-hmm. either.
No, I'm currently
in a more tongues.
personal headbutting match within my own mind between sous vide versus no sous vide, and the love hate kind of going on. And
explain that. Give me the argument against each.
Well, if anyone out there does or does not, if you do not know what sous vide cookery is basically in French. I think it translates to cooked in vacuum, and it's basically your taking anything, putting it in a plastic bag of some kind, moving all the air out.
Ziploc, vac seal bag.
Exactly. Yeah. And then submerging that bag in water bath and using an immersion wand, a heated wand, to then circulate and maintain a temperature within the water, which then brings that food that in the bag to that temperature and holds it at that temperature.
Dude, you're doing a great job right now. I feel like we should just have you on hand. just now and then to do an explanation of something.
I didn't know what sous vide was. That was super educational.
Well, it's been around since like the 70s.
Yeah.
And yet it's just hip. Like GPS. Cool,
I always hear it, and then when people are like sous vide, I'm like, oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about.
I always thought that was something like so new.
Well, but it's new to us. So GPS is not new to the world, but it's so like so many things that require development and R&D. There's a ton of time and energy and money. It goes into that. So it's usually developed for the industry, and then it comes down to the consumer.
Yeah, I think it's already like, when was the life cycle in like New York restaurants of sous vide?
Well, they didn't quit. That's where it found its use. That's where it found its thing. Is you could if you're a caterer, say, or you're doing a wedding, and you need to have at 6 o'clock, you're going to serve 100 4-ounce steaks.
Mm.
Okay, it would be that you could have this giant tank with a circulator in there, and all those sons of bitch and steaks are in there at 130 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. But
and they're just also ready to go, and then you pull them out, put a sear on them, put a flame on them, and wham, 100 out the door at the same time. Or you could pre-prep all these entrees and have them all ready, and you start serving dinner at 5, and you're serving dinner till 1 in the morning in a bistro, and all this shit is just like done. It's done. Order comes in, you grab the bag out, open the bag up, put a sear on it, it's fucking scallops, whatever, put a sear on them, out the door, and you're just basically grabbing sacks out of a hot tank of water, putting the finishing touches on it, dress the dish, go out the door.
But wouldn't you agree also
and
that
it's not like they quit doing that because it got hip.
They're still doing it.
Right, but I think that there was a hipness at one point to it where people were like, I am going to find a sous vide steak, fillet, or whatever, because sure, it is special.
When it was on the menu listed, like
yes,
sous vide New York, or
right,
rather than being to some secret trick that would be off-putting to people.
Everyone remember when kale was all over the menu? It's like, not kale's not fucking new to anyone.
Yeah, because like someone started busting kale's balls because it's got like what's wrong with kale? Everybody got hip on kale, and then it came out that everybody started busting balls on kale because kale has some problem.
So I have no problem with kale. But when it comes to sous vide cookery, it was developed in the late 70s, early 80s, and went through the industrial use. And then just, I think it hit the restaurant scene like in the late 90s and then 2000s. And then consumers, I think I didn't start seeing a purchasable. You go to Amazon and buy a wand, which is what they're called. It's an immersion wand. And
Breville. Yeah. Breville has
the Jewel, the
Anova.
Anova, that's the one I have. And you can control them with an app on your phone. So it's just a continuation of these tools like GPS and hunting now and Onyx on our phone and everything else. Like, these things that enable us to just continue to be badass at what we want to do in our world. But my thing with sous vide is, yes, you could take the toughest cut of meat. And I've been doing more and more of this where I will literally, some people wrap in plastic wrap and then butcher paper if you're butchering at home. I really stick to vacuum sealed, you know, almost everything. I just feel that you can freeze it for longer. And what I've started to do is I'll thaw the item in the bag and I'll go directly into the sous vide machine once it's thawed. So rather than,
you can throw it in frozen.
You can throw it in frozen, but you better account for that because it takes a lot longer. But so here's the deal, is that you can sous vide a tough cut, like we'll just call it a deer shank, and then pull it out 20 hours later at 170 degrees, and it's falling apart tender now. But there is no caramelization of sugars, which is when you have a steak or when you have a crispy fried egg or when you have a brûlée creme brûlée, the cooking of sugar to the point where it's about to turn into candy or burn is caramelization, and it's a beautiful thing. Like it's like frying that tongue meat that Danielle's talking about. And so what happens is when you're sous vide cooking, you're wet cooking, and there's no there's no, none of the sugars are being developed to a point of caramel. And so you're just losing on a ton of flavor. And so the old school method, pre-sous vide, which is to make something, so you're trying to make something tender, is you're braising, which is you're browning it, and then you're putting it in a water or stock bath of some kind. You're putting it with liquid and aromatics like carrots and onions and garlic, and then you're slow cooking. So you're doing the same thing sous vide's doing, but you're browning it first. And all that browning is going into the braising liquid, which then can become a beautiful gravy or sauce, right? So that's where my love-hate comes in, is like with sous vide, it's like you can put flavorings in the bag and then seal it up. And so it's I love it, but at the same time, sometimes I don't want to let a shit, like I could cook a deer shank right now. What time is it? It's like 10:30. I could cook a deer shank right now through traditional braising, brown it, liquid in the oven, 280 degrees, 6 hours, and it will be ready for dinner at 6 p.m., like falling off the bone. And the gravy in that pan is ready to go. All I have to do is mash the potatoes, right?
So I'll counter that by saying I'll sear it before, like a roast. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll sear it in a pan, mm-hmm. put it in the bag. I'll put just a little bit of suck on the pan to sort of wipe up that fond, pour it in the bag.
Mm-hmm. What was the word? What's the word you just used?
The fond.
Never heard that word.
You've got your own word. I noticed it on the glossary term.
Scraping.
Scraping. Fond. Fond is another word for scrapings?
Mm-hmm.
Scrapings is another word this word? For fond.
Yeah, fond is the fancy culinary term.
Dude, how do I not know so much stuff, man? I don't know.
You read Escoffier. You know probably missed it because you're
deglaze
drinking
the
an
pan
IPA.
To get the fond to lift off.
I get it. I get it. I just have never heard it described as fond.
I'm interested.
It doesn't take the same root as fondue.
No.
Obviously. No, so never heard the word fond. At least I admit it. A lot of dudes sit here going like, uh-huh.
That's
right?
Okay.
But I'm like, never heard that
word. Well, through your admittance now, everyone knows what fond
is. Yeah. So I'll do that.
Yeah.
And then a lot of juices still extract from that meat, and you have like a little bit, maybe like half a cup of really nice juices in there. But I agree, on something like a shank, you miss out on like really building a flavorful braise liquid.
Yeah.
So for something like osso buco or anything like that, I would probably always braise it.
Versus sous vide. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and so, and really, okay, so I'm going to distill my love-hate down just to make it really clear. It's a time thing. So the recipe that I've known to come by if I want meat to fall off the shank bone is roughly 20 hours at 170 degrees Fahrenheit. That's just what it takes. Mm-hmm. That's a long time. So you
for
gotta,
sous vide or
for
sous trad?
To sous vide.
Sous vide, okay.
Whereas, and you just have to plan ahead. You just do, right? But I don't always have the luxury of planning ahead. So for me, 6 hours, old school style, in the oven, out of the oven, one pot, one pan. It's really just as simple. It just takes less time. Mm-hmm. And you do end up with like a quart or a substantial amount of gravy that's pretty beautiful.
Yeah.
So they're both great techniques.
Can I throw, and then I'm gonna ask you another question.
Let's go.
I'll throw in one more thought in here. I think that when an argument in favor of doing, say, osso buco sous vide is that you don't need to be there to monitor it. And the window of it being done is a much broader window, right?
Yeah.
It's like very safe to like leave your home, leave this thing in there.
Yes.
You'd be like, yeah, it'll be done maybe around 6 p.m. In this case, like 6 p.m. tomorrow.
Yep.
But, you know, 10 p.m., it'll be kind of the same way.
So I would argue that, I'm just going to add to that. These are all great options for anybody listening to get into, right, is a crock pot. You know, crock pot's electrical.
Exactly.
It's super bomber and safe. It's no different than putting it in the oven. And in a way,
gentle.
Yeah, with the lid on it, it's self-basting, meaning you're evaporating the broth and up to the lid, and it's falling back down onto the meat. And that's, I mean, people win. Home cooks that are busier than I am win every day with a crock pot. Like, great invention, right?
Somehow, though, I feel like if I do the same exact recipe, let's just say osso buco.
Yeah.
In a crock pot and then the Dutch oven with the lid in the oven, I feel like I get a different result.
Right.
Better or
worse. You know why that is?
I think the oven is a little bit better.
You're right. It's better.
And I think that it's somehow there's like a different kind of reduction going on. Like maybe the
the lid, the way the lid you peeled off and you got like a something that tastes really good stuck to the lid of your Dutch oven.
Yeah,
out of your oven.
I think
and that shit isn't there on a crock pot.
I think it has to do with its dry heat versus wet heat. Yeah. When you're in a crock pot, it's a steam-based environment again. And when you're in an oven, the exterior of that crock pot is all dry heat. It's just, it's a different, it's like, you know, being warmed by the sun being versus being warmed by a sauna. So mm-hmm. just, it's different.
I was going to say wood fireplace versus sauna.
There you
good,
go.
Good analogy.
Yeah.
Let me ask you another question. Then I'm going to ask Danielle another question. Here's my question for you. If you're living out of a freezer, like eating out of a freezer all the time, you were talking earlier about pulling the tongue out and letting it just go into the fridge and let it take its time. How do you like to thaw fish out of your freezer?
Countertop, room temperature.
You do?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
What about you?
I do that. I do in my fridge. I do in a vac bag in cold water, depending. I just didn't know if there was like, because you have a lot of like technical training.
Yeah.
And sort of like where you have this, you know, you have like what works, but there's also like food safety issues and all that kind of shit from commercial kitchens. I didn't know if you had a different perspective on thawing fish. If you had like never, you can't ever set it on your counter.
No, you can. I mean, the only thing I would say is size matters here. So if you are thawing out some huge piece of fish, like larger than a turkey, you
like
know?
The belly off a 50 pound flathead.
Okay, well, so the only caution here is that at that point I would thaw in the fridge and I would give it 4 days, and the only reason why is so it's a controlled environment where the extremities of that piece of meat are never reaching an ambient room temp of 50 or 60 while the inside's still frozen and you're waiting for that to happen. Whereas it's always going to be at the outside's 30 something or 40, whatever your fridge is at, as it slacks.
That's a good point. Cause you pull like let's say you're thawing out a venison neck.
Oh, it'll take forever.
Some bitch is sitting on your counter. It's sitting in like a pool of its own blood.
Yeah.
It's all just looks like all sad and warm. Then you get in there and it's still, you're like still icy in the middle.
Fridge.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Okay. Nice. Do you guys want to talk about kidneys or hearts first? Game kidneys or game hearts first?
I've actually never cooked a game any kidney.
Really? Let's talk about game hearts.
I haven't either. I'd like to, if anybody has some experience with
you probably kidneys. Had to have eaten it with me.
I mean, maybe in a
scrambles.
No, I was going to say like in what is it called? Giblets?
Giblets.
Giblets.
Yeah, I made kidney pudding with elk kidney. Tastes like piss. I messed it up. I didn't do it right. But when I do kidneys, I just cube them up. I know you've had this with me.
No. Did you do it on the Fognac elk kidney with the...
Yeah, you ate kidney there.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that was like it's amongst...
It's a kidney.
Liver. No, I know. But I'm saying like, okay, sure. So yes, I have ingested it. But as we were eating, that dish, I wasn't like, "Oh, that's what kidney tastes like." Like very heavily seasoned with a bunch of other cuts in. This
okay, yeah. Do I walk around combat? Eating a kidney like an apple? No. What do I? Have you had it the way most people have it, where you peel the skin, you're supposed to give it a good soak, cube it up, and put it in like an egg scramble. Put it in an Oregon scramble with Mo Fallon, with Mo Make the Camera Bleed Fallon. We even had kidney, lung, heart.
That was either pre Yanni.
Were you working for us when we filmed in New Zealand?
Nope.
Oh, all right. Were you working for us when we filmed up on the breaks?
Nope.
You weren't?
I was part-time, but I had other commitments that fall guiding, and so that was one of the trips that I...
You weren't full balls.
Did not go on.
Okay.
I've never cooked game kidney, and I have a collection of them in the freezer right now that I've been wanting to do a steak and kidney pie, just pot pies, like a big Dutch oven pot pie. I think that'd be good. I think the thing with kidneys, if you look historically, it's organ meat, and it's one of those things that... is protein. However, I'm certain they realize that it, you know, to just cook it medium rare and slice it like a steak is like, yeah, it tastes okay.
Yeah.
However, when it's dressed properly with a sauce and accompanying things, it's darn palatable. And sometimes I think, you know, you can look historically at recipes and be like, oh, they've been doing that for a long time. That's why it succeeds. Yeah. So that I have an interest in doing kidney pie for sure.
Kidney, in my opinion, kidney falls into the trifecta of wild game ingredients that need to come from young critters.
Hmm.
Like anybody who's ever had sweetbreads, anybody who's eaten sweetbreads in a restaurant, like a sweetbread is a thymus gland. It is delectable. It is phenomenal off veal. So like a six-month-old cow to get slaughtered, the thymus gland or the sweetbread is beautiful. As the animal gets older, it turns the gland matures into this kind of waxy thing that no one eats.
Yeah.
I can't remember which Plains tribe, maybe it was the Blackfeet, had a belief that, or at least here's the way Euro-Americans who spent time among them captured what they took to be their belief. I always want to clarify that nowadays. That at a time, buffalo hunted and ate humans. And then humans got the bow and turned the tides and began hunting buffalo and eating them. And that the thymus gland was a chunk of human meat still stuck in the buffalo's throat. Again, this is as explained by a Euro-American traveler who traveled and hunted among them. So he could have got it all wrong.
Yeah.
But that was his take on what was going on.
One missed word could have totally sent that story.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah, because you hear a lot of stuff, and you're like, now that you understand kind of like how these things pass along, you realize that shit gets missed. But that was his take on it. However, it turns to wax later. Like, I've tried to pull thymus glands out of game animals, and it's just nothing like, you know, I've peeled sweetbreads out of veal. It's nothing. They're not the same. I think the other two components would be liver. An old, like you take a liver out of a four-year-old whitetail, it is not the same thing at all.
Yeah.
Than a liver out of a fawn of the year. And kidneys don't improve with age.
So can I throw a question in on top of this?
Yeah.
Okay, age of what you're harvesting and eating. What's everyone's opinion on eating baby animals versus full-grown animals?
I think that a big... I used to be like, you know, people used to say this all the time, like, oh, the big ones don't taste good. Dude, I'm telling you, there is nothing on this planet that is better than a big, big mule deer bucks that when you pull their hide, they got like an inch of fat on their back.
Is that the answer you're wanting to get at? Or is it more of the... killing a young animal versus an old animal?
All of it. I mean, there's six of us here. I mean, so I'm with Steve. One of my favorite recipes that my dad used to make, he would ask me to go harvest an old mule deer buck because we knew it would have huge fat on it, and he wanted that as part of the thickening agent for his sauce. But some folks, you know, like maybe look at a spotted fawn and they're like, I couldn't kill that. You know, so I just wonder what, it, you know, like anything across the board.
No, I don't have any, the morality of it or the ethics of it or the aesthetics of it. I don't give a shit either way. It doesn't matter to me at all.
Yeah, it doesn't matter to me. I always grew up as far as like eating old versus young. I always grew up with people like I grew up with a lot of meat hunters.
And Pennsylvania meat hunters.
Yeah. And I always they always said like. Old bucks are just nasty.
Yeah.
Growing up, I had that in my head, but like...
Oh, people pound it in your head.
Yeah.
You shoot a little buck and be like, oh, that's a good eater.
Yeah. But, yeah. You know, as I've, you know, got more into like cooking my own shit, I've never noticed a difference. I mean, I've noticed like with mule deer, I don't know what the reasoning is, but like last year, I had four different mule deer in my freezer. And I made the mistake of not labeling which deer was what. And some of those deer, just tougher than hell, had like a, like a real like irony taste to it. Okay. I don't know if it's because I handled it wrong. And then other deer.
Were they crippled up, limping around for 4 days before you found them?
No.
No?
Okay. And other mule deer were just phenomenal.
Yeah. We did, not last year, 2 years ago, we did a Pepsi challenge. We had a year and a half old buck and probably, what, a three-year-old buck?
Maybe, yeah.
Four-year-old buck. Eating the sumbitch raw. So it's like back legs. Now, granted, one had been aged for a few days and one wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
So that's substantial. But
it's substantial because one was literally in rigor mortis, that young buck.
But
however, really throws off the challenge.
It throws off the challenge, but it also informs the challenge.
Yes.
Okay? Because everyone thought the big buck was better, just as eating it as carpaccio. So even though they weren't totally equal and it wouldn't hold up to scientific rigor, the test, it does say that handling, it suggests, it might suggest to one that handling actually trumps age of animal.
Mm, sure.
Here, I have a question.
You cool with that, Giannis?
Oh, I totally agree with that.
Last year, one of the, like, we always have a big deer camp every year. One of the deer that was shot, was it was like neck shot, dropped immediately. And we immediately went over there and started working on it. And like as we were cutting some of the muscle groups, they're like still twitching and stuff.
Yeah.
Do you think that causes any problems as far as like taste, toughness?
Can't say.
You mean in regards to not waiting until the nerves have kind of run their
settled,
course?
Yeah, and settled down.
To cut it? I don't know.
That's people talk about that all the time as if it's like life and death. Like don't mess with it until that time has passed. But think about how many people shoot a deer and the temperatures are in the 70s. You can't wait around.
Yeah.
It's imperative to get that cooled off as fast as possible. But there's like post-processing things you can do, like wet aging, dry aging. Like you were saying, I think that trumps the age of the animal. Like how you take care of it in the field and at home makes a bigger difference than it does how old you shot. Except when it comes to waterfowl. I think waterfowl is totally different. I think a young bird is going to be insanely tender and an old bird is just not.
Yes. Okay, we're getting a lot of ideas stacked on top of each other.
Okay, sorry.
No, I want to get to this. And I was hoping to talk about hearts, but now we get this more important stuff coming up. We're getting a lot of ideas stacked. I want to put two to bed.
Get into the heart of it.
Yeah. I'm going to put two things to bed. One, when I was talking about thymus glands, kidneys, and livers, it's better on young animals. And this is something that's always been widely accepted in cuisine, is that those organs, for whatever, like as they live out their life of filtering or the animal matures or something, they just change. The texture on them changes. The flavor on them changes, and it's to the point where in the commercial industry, it's a difference between going to market and going to a rendering plant. Not that they know everything and they get everything right, but these are like broadly accepted. In the red, in the horned and antlered game world, I think that there's a tremendous amount of mystery. I think that there's, one, huge variabilities between the animals' life histories. This is a point I make in our new Wild Game Cookbook that we have coming out. It's like not all things are equal. As far as you know, some buck coming at you through the woods, he might have spent 3 days hung up on a barbed wire fence with coyotes chewing on him. And then he finally gets himself off there, and then he comes through the woods, and you shoot him, and that's his life history that you'll never know. And that makes a big difference. He might have wintered in some shitty spot and been starving to death all winter. There's so much variability with the animals that you just don't know. And you might get something that tastes off and blame yourself for it and puzzle over, oh, if I had not hung it for a day or had I hung it longer. Like, you don't know. The the commercial meat processing industry is that they have got things standardized to a bizarre degree. It's like you have an animal of a known lineage. It's born. It's fed a certain diet. It hits 800 pounds. It goes on to a feed mixture of X percent corn and X percent this. It's treated with this. It gets to 1,100 pounds. It goes to slaughter. They all line up. The exact same thing happens to every one of them. The exact same process time happens to every one of them. They go into a cooler for just about the exact same time, and it comes out, and it's like they're stamping them out like a car factory.
Mm-hmm. I was just about to
and
say
it's like
that.
They know the variability shit. They kind of know. It's not like, you know, it's not like, hey, let's let this one lay out in the sun for a while.
Yeah. When you go to the store to buy beef, you know what you're getting and what it's going to taste like. There's like no question about that. When you're hunting, you have no idea what you're coming home
no,
with.
No, what it's already been through. So I think that's what leads to a lot of the mystery about, oh, this one time we had a whatever. I mean, my brother killed a bull elk one time. Nothing you did to that son of a bitch. It was hard to chew up. It was like any other elk. Bull elk, 6-point bull coming across the mountain. Bam, bull falls over dead. It's cold out. Do the same thing you do with every elk. You could never chew that son of a bitch. I don't know what happened to it. Not that that puts that thing to rest, because now we're entering into like really interesting territory where I think that like fowl, rabbits, squirrels, that's some age-specific shit there, I think. If you kill a cottontail rabbit and you can tear its ear, you can tear its ear like a piece of paper after it's dead. That's a young rabbit. It's just a different critter than an old rabbit. Mm-hmm. And a pheasant that's 2-3 years old.
Oh yeah.
Ain't the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just take that thing and throw it on a grill.
When you're cleaning pheasant, you can tell the difference, like a younger pheasant and an older pheasant. The way that meat comes off that bone is just totally different than like an old rooster. You're like, you're cutting it off the breastplate. And a young one, you're like, this is kind of just peeled off. You're like, there's something wrong with that. It's just so tender.
Yeah, and you could tell you can take the pheasant's wing, stretch the pheasant's wing off, and see if all the primary feathers are the same. If all the primary feathers are the same length, it's an older bird, and I would braise that bird. Mm-hmm. I would slow cook that bird. If the primary feathers aren't, it's different.
So how many folks, we kind of get into Chris and Giannis still, though, and I mean, I'm just still curious about.
You want to talk about that gray rabbit?
like, we're hunting. We're all hunters at this table. So hunting is the super conscious act of setting your sight literally and figuratively on a one thing and then harvesting it, hopefully. So, like, are you targeting age ever? You know, I mean, like with birds, that must be crazy challenging. How the heck do you target a bird while it's flying?
I don't think you could with any small game.
As long as it's not a hen. Well, pheasant.
Yeah, I think the only time I've done that is when I have a cow elk tag and I've gotten it onto a herd and you can see who's like big mama lead cow.
Yeah.
My buddy Jimmy Miller calls her Jenny Long Muzzle. You know, she's got like a 20-inch muzzle on her.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, she's usually leading the pack. And then behind her, you've got like the mediums. And then hopefully there's some calves around, you know, because you really need to see all of the sizes to make the call. Because oftentimes, like the cow I killed last year, she's by herself with a bull, young 5-point bull, 2-3 years old, you know. And I'm like, oh, perfect size, medium cow.
Oh, so that's what I was going to ask. You want the mediums. You don't want Jenny Long Nose.
No.
What's her name?
Long muzzle. Yeah. But so I shoot her, walk up to her, and bye, you know, just a giant, you know, and she's been eaten like with a. Steve didn't think so. I served some when we were in Missouri.
Dude, I thought it was great.
Everybody thought it was like,
I thought it was good. Best elk you've been, ever, bitch, but... you've been bitching about that elk all year. I thought it was the best thing I'd had in a long time.
She's just got just a little more al dente than. Then maybe it, but then again, it could be like all these factors, right? Coincidence and this, that, and the other that we're just not, you don't know what happened. But anyway, no, that's the cow, only time.
That's the thing. There's cows running around out there. If you're in hunt season, there's cows running around out there that are 8 months old, and there's cows running out there that are 20 years old.
Yes.
So
what about you, Chris?
Well, I'm pretty spoiled. I don't really have an opinion on it, but I'm spoiled because like, whenever I eat game meat, it's always cooked by like everybody at this table and everybody at this table aside from me is a good cook. So like whatever I'm eating, I'm stoked on it. You know, so I don't have enough experience in my own like culinary world to know like, oh, a young animal versus an older animal or
so whatever. Let me ask you a question outside, like we'll go conventional for a second.
Yeah.
If you're buying groceries,
yep.
Are you buying mixed baby greens or whole heads of lettuce?
Baby greens.
Okay, there you go. So you like babies too.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, so that's...
So you're saying that you'll select... Like, let's say you're hunting deer and you got a smorgasbord of them out in front of you.
Yeah.
You shoot for young?
I'll do both. So I try to pull... I try to pull tags for my area that if I can get some surplus tags or get a few B tags, I'll try to go for a young, like let's call it max 3-year-old male of any species because I think it has higher weight, you know, so I'm going to be bringing more meat to the freezer home. Yeah,
that's an important thing.
And it's probably the only sure way in the big game world that I know of to tell an age is a raghorn or a forked horn or something along, you know, like, you know, by its antler size, how old it is. Whereas that cow at 300 yards, that cow elk, you really don't know if it's going to be Jenny the long muzzle or, you know, Jenny the short muzzle. And so I try to go with that, my A tag every year. And then with a B tag, I will. So that's my meat. That's bringing home some weight, is like a forked horn or rag horn. And then with the B tag, I target, whitetail or mule deer doe tags. We don't get a lot where I'm at, but whitetail, I'll target small, like first year, second year animals. And that specifically for whole leg cooking and just tender meat and even the organ meats that are terrific. When young.
So you're shooting for the freezer.
Yeah. And then it brings it to the next level where I'm like, well, how do I kill this? If I do a heart shot, it ruins a lot of good stuff in there. If I do a like an upper base of the skull shot, then it's less, but you have a higher risk of missing. So it's a combination of when I'm going for the younger animals, the harvest, I don't know anyone else. I hit that all the time. I'm like, all right, I try to put myself in a place where I know that I can make a like upper neck shot and not lose a shoulder because it steps right when I shoot, or that sucks for me when I end up losing a ton of meat through
my solution to that is copper bullets and just punch them in the shoulder.
Yeah.
Cause I feel like just like you're not getting that crazy purple trauma.
Yeah.
You from still
conventional
get,
bullets.
I'm with you, but you still get meat loss.
Yeah. Yeah. No,
and I've switched to
obviously
copper.
You can't go without it, but, I feel like you're still like, it's still a shot where you can just drop them in their tracks and, mm-hmm. but go over there and cut out, you know, a couple inches versus sometimes looking at like stuff that extends out like a foot on either side of the bullet hole.
But Eduardo, you still shoot big, huge, giant bulls.
Maybe 3 in my life.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't think of those as being fundamentally different, right? They're different, but you don't look down on them.
Meat tastes great, everything else, but I know that with like a 2-year-old bull, that loin or backstrap is just totally different than a 6-year-old bull.
Yeah,
I think so. 6-year-old bull backstrap, the way I like to cook it is I'm tenderizing the heck out of it with like the heel of a knife or a fork or whatnot, almost like what do they call that? Like a Swiss steak or something, where they're kind of breaking all that connective tissue with like a cutter or something or a pounder.
So let me ask you this, and you got to be honest in your answer.
Okay.
You've gotten some big smoker bulls,
mm-hmm.
but you're saying like generally, if you had a big tanker, let's not say like a big tanker, you're like, holy shit, I'll never see one like that again the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
But like a nice 6
mm-hmm.
and a raghorn, typically you're saying you would shoot the raghorn.
Yeah. Unless it's like over 370.
Unless it's like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Totally. I'd rather pick up their sheds.
And you got a pile of them.
I'd rather pick up their sheds because then you can like, it's like the gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've shed a tear before when like we did, not that I would have said no, but my brother-in-law shot a bull and I was like, I recognize that. Like something in me at however many hundred yards we were away, recognized that bull somehow, like the face and the colorings and maybe even the antlers a little bit. And then when we walked up to it, it was like, I was the first one there. And I just, without even a shadow of a doubt, I was like, I know that bull. I have his sheds. I was like, oh, fuck. Never going to, you know, pick up those sheds again. But yeah, you know, I my joy with antler hunting, big antler hunting, I love getting first time, like, people, folks that are have never, you know, gone out and got a king of the woods, you know, to put on their wall or whatever they want. I'm all about that. It's a beautiful thing. And I love taking folks out for that. Yeah, big time.
Okay. Danielle, can you walk us through your heart recipe? Do your heart recipe.
The one I just did? Or yeah, man.
I want to leave people with a good...
If you want to leave people with that, then I want to bring up one more thing about this. We're talking about waterfowl and
oh, shit, how it yeah. tastes. No, please go ahead.
Because our buddy Boomer Hesley wrote in, and I think I mentioned this to you, about how we're always talking about meat care for big game in the field. But rarely is that ever brought up for small game, upland, waterfowl. And he was saying, like, yeah, in Montana, you shoot a bird today, probably pretty chilled out in 30 minutes, right? Even with all the feathers and on it, whatnot. But if it's a 60, 70 degree day down south and you're not gutting immediately because you're spending 3-4 hours in the duck blind, like, how is that changing the meat? You know, how is that changing flavors, you know, that you got going on in there?
You're asking me?
Yeah, I'm just kind of throwing that out there because it's just it's something that I feel like we're hammering on it with about like
yeah.
getting guts out and hanging big game, this, that, and the other, and it's just not nearly discussed as much with
I got a few basic waterfowl. Thoughts. I got a few basic thoughts on it. But again, because it's wild game, I can't like come and tell you absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're not nearly as vulnerable to spoilage as are mammals, large mammals.
Okay.
You know, large mammals, they're so big and there's so much heat in there and they got that gut, right? That is depending on, you know, what it was up to. They got that gut that's just full of gallons of stuff that's like ruminating in their gut and producing gas, right? It's just different. I think they're not nearly as vulnerable to spoilage. And I think there's something about the chest cavity on a bird that sort of, you can have one thing going on inside the gut cavity, and it's not as readily permeating its surroundings because of the breastbone and that you're not really eating the meat out of the inside of the back. So if you leave a big game animal ungutted for too long, you wind up losing all the organ meat. The inside tenderloins spoil very quickly. You have spoilage that starts at the ball joints and the rear legs and seems to spread very quickly. I just don't see it like moving around like a rot doesn't move around a bird in this sort of like cancerous way that rot moves around a big animal. But if you like to eat the gizzards and the liver and the hearts, which are all worth a try, I think that you need to get them out of there in a hurry. And also there's a thing to do with just like how pleasant the cleaning process is. And with squirrels, rabbits, ducks, geese, pheasants, after a few hours of wandering around in your game bag on a warm day, it just becomes like gutting them and cleaning them becomes not as fun because the smell is so offensive and horrible. And it just leaves you with a negative feeling about it. And I think if you could take a duck or goose, pheasant, whatever, and it happens to be you get some snow on the ground, right? And you quickly gut it out, clean everything out, pack some snow in there, wipe it all out, clean your heart, liver, gizzard, shove them back in there. It just is clean and nice and beautiful. And it's not like that, just the nastiness of gutting a bird that you should have gutted a long time ago. But for what I would like, the best duck that I've dealt with, then I'm going to be done talking about it. You guys can talk about it. The best duck that I've dealt with has been like, take a duck, gut it, clean it up. I put it in a brown paper grocery sack. I roll that brown paper grocery sack up, and I stack those sons of bitches in my fridge like firewood, and then I don't mess with them for 3 or 4 days.
Gutted?
Gutted.
Yeah.
wrapped in a newsprint or grocery sacks. And a little bit of that wrapping is just like it keeps it from drying out because you got that gutting incision, so everything starts to dry from there. And also some people like don't like it. And there's like parasites in the feathers that get all over shit. And so your wife opens it up and it's kind of like, what in the world? But if you just like roll it up in newsprint or roll it up in a brown paper bag, put it in there for 3 or 4 days, and you get it out and you get like a duck, and it winds up being that you could almost picture scraping that breast meat away with your thumb. That shit is good. That's all I got to say about it.
Didn't in generations past, and help me out if you guys know this story. Wouldn't they hang it by the neck, and when it fell to the ground, and you still had the head up in the string or the noose,
then it was ready.
Then it was ready.
That's like a Escoffier stuff, man.
Yeah,
I used to hang a bunch of my birds in North Dakota. Yeah. It was always, we do it in a garage, and it really.
Sorry, quick question interruption. Gutted or not gutted?
I did both.
Okay, this is interesting. I want to hear this.
I honestly can't remember if I thought there was a huge difference between the two, gutted and not gutted. But I'd say most of them,
well,
I
the
did.
The liver
all
damn
of them.
Sure would be different.
Yeah, I don't think the ones that we kept internals in, we didn't need those.
Oh, yeah, they'd be nasty.
So, yeah. So, like, if the ones that we did gut, we would keep that sort of stuff. But, yeah, we, a lot of times, we come home from a hunt, depending on the temperature, our garage could sort of stay insulated. And if it was the right time of the year, if it didn't get too cold below freezing, we would just hang them up in the garage. We'd have what we hang our deer on. We'd just get the straps. I have all of them hanging up there. And it was nice because I would only come home from work, clean like 2 birds a night. The next night, clean another 2 birds. And I'd always write on the package how many days they were aged. And I actually have a lot in my freezer that I need to take each day out that I aged it for to tell the difference. We did it with a lot of Canada geese and some snows. But I've always found that snows are always tender no matter what, especially in the Ross's geese. And I couldn't age... The problem is I couldn't tell if aging it really tenderized the meat or if that goose was just a much younger goose versus an older goose.
Yeah.
So it's like you just keep getting these variabilities that you're just like, how do you create the same standardization to test all these things? It's really hard. And then the weather changes and I'm like, I can't hang these. I got to clean them all now or whatever. But
that's my brother who's a statistician. He's an ecologist, but does a lot of statistical modeling and statistical analysis. And he like a pet peeve of his is people who look and they make assumptions about the constants. And they're like, oh, it seems like the pheasants that you kill on a Monday taste better than the ones you kill on a Wednesday. Because he's like, there are so many variables going on all the time. And people go like, the smallmouth bass are only hitting chartreuse.
Mm-hmm.
Because I tied a chartreuse on and caught a smallmouth all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. It was like, okay, but the angle of the sun also changed. The barometric pressure also changed. Your boat moved.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's really, people, hunting and fishing people always want to be like, that's it.
Yeah.
It's chartreuse. Yeah. It's Monday.
Yeah, people want a hard answer, and it's not easy thing to answer because you're tired after a hunt. Like, it's hard to like get a piece of paper out and say, I have X amount of snow goose. This one is all white. This one has a lot of gray in it. I know that one's like, and then mark it. How many days? It's like, that's like serious research going on. And, and you don't always, and I was working a full-time job of North Dakota. And so it was just like all those things at that point in time didn't really click that I should be like documenting. Because we had so many birds that I really could have done a really nice study, but I just didn't think about that at the time.
Did you ever hang them long enough that it fell off from
the head? No, but I hung it long enough that my dog ate a whole goose, and then we were like, all right, that's enough.
I'm gonna hang a duck this year until its body falls off.
I was going to say, I just made it.
Actually, I have done that before. I have had the body fall off, but I think the neck had already been broken from the string, so I don't think it counts. It's not a true...
Not a true lynching.
Yeah, but you got to keep the temperature really constant or in between.
Maybe. I don't know if in medieval times they had the opportunity to do that, unless they had a root cellar or something that was 50s or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But I made a lot of notes here. So if I have the opportunity to be back on this podcast, I'm going to have answers to a lot of these things because I'm going to test them this winter. Birdfowl, mule deer fat. What the hell is shot gobble? That was in the beginning of our...
Oh, shot gobble is when a turkey... do you hunt much turkeys?
No.
Okay. Man. A shot gobble is when a turkey gobbles to a sudden noise that isn't another turkey.
Mm-hmm.
So for whatever reason, when they're amped up in the spring and they're gobbling a lot, they get so keyed up, as Lil Primo says, it's just them announcing to the world that it's their time of year. They get so keyed up that just any kind of sudden alarming noise,
okay,
they'll gobble to it.
Thunder.
The same way they'll gobble to a gobble. Really, you think like a turkey, one turkey gobbles, he's like, gobble, gobble, gobble. And another turkey's like, you're not the man, I'm the man, gobble, 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 right? But they get like, with just anything going on. So dogs barking, thunder, and we have kind of a running list of things that people have heard turkeys respond to. I've like sonic booms, Seth throwing a rock at a stop sign, car doors slamming, car horns going off, dogs barking, crows cawing, blue jays,
geese honking,
a red-tailed hawk going, arr!
So shot?
Shock.
Oh, it's a shock gobble.
It shocks them.
I thought it was with a T, shot, and I was thinking,
they do shock gobble the shots.
They shock gobble the shotguns, damn sure.
Well, see, question answered. Can I add one thing? I don't know how close you are here, but...
No, go ahead, man. So I decided I'm going to end on something different.
Okay.
But you go ahead.
I just wanted to add a thought onto the gray rabbit story for
Is this a redemption? Some sort of saving?
Yeah, well, I think we have to have takeaways. This can't just be shooting the shit.
No.
And so if I was to offer anything that I believe to be truth in when it comes to cooking, wild game or not, this is just broadline cooking, is methodology super key, you know? And just as we spend so much time focused on the gear, the technique, mm-hmm. how many hours we spend on Google Maps and everything else pouring over where we're going to go and what we're going to go do. And if you enjoy a good meal, that chef in that restaurant and that entire team has spent equivalent amount of time researching how to make your meal great, right? So they're doing the exact same thing you're doing in preparation for hunting, in preparation of a meal. And so though it may sound daunting, you don't need to be a chef to be a good cook, is to focus on methodology. Because methodology, you see a bumpy two-track road, you know four-wheel drive on, dunk. You see more than 12 inches of snow, you know, maybe it's drifted, it's 24 inches of snow, you know, chains on, right? Those are the things we've learned. So with methodology, and maybe we can get here on a later podcast or we can write about it, is methodology is your snow chains and four-wheel drive and, you know, rain jacket, and it is your tool to cookery, is knowing good methodology. So you get a super tough animal with braising techniques, with proper methodology, smoking, you're going to break that thing down and it'll be palatable. So to the gray rabbit, one thing that is less methodology but is still a skill, and Danielle said it in the very beginning, which is we eat with our eyes, right? Mm-hmm. And so one of the easiest, put lipstick on your food. And what I mean by that is put your makeup on. Like garnishing a dish is one of the most underrated, easy to do things that changes the experience for anybody. So your gray rabbit, and you know, you have your, you know, hopeful sweetheart or whomever coming over to eat, and you're like, man, this is not looking, you know, how I want it. Fresh herbs, fresh chopped herbs, not only add great flavor to it, but
adds like a pop
visual
and deal. Visually, yeah. It's like makeup, it's mascara for your food. It's like when you see chopped parsley or chopped herbs on food, it's like, oh, this was like,
it's cared,
you know,
for.
This there's, was there's... done by someone that knows what's up, mm-hmm. you know. And so I would just add that in, and that is that methodology is going to become really key for folks that want to get into game cookery. And then garnishing, just a little bit of fresh herbs on there, or, you know, crumbled dried bacon, or, you know, just adding a little extra something,
mm-hmm.
gives it a mask, gives it a top coat, you know.
Yeah, I'll agree with you on that. I think these methods are the foundation. And once you figure out those things, then everything clicks. You can cook anything because it's the same process over and over again. So,
Ridge Pounder, do you think that would you rather that we call you the Gray Rabbit?
No, 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 no. Thank you.
GR.
I mean,
instead of RP.
It's not bad.
The Gray Rabbit.
You just don't really know the story. You know what? I'll embrace the story. There's a people out there that have probably been in that same predicament. It's a good learning experience.
Oh yeah, man. I remember in cooking school when I was 18, I served a pasta dish with a sauce called arrabbiata. It's like a spicy tomato sauce. Yeah. You know, in restaurants you'll see penne arrabbiata a lot. And so I was making. She just was like we'd been dating for like a month, and I was in culinary school. I was 18 years old, and I'm like trying to pull out all these tricks. But I made a penne arrabbiata, and she found a goddamn nipple in her dish.
A human nipple?
No.
Oh.
No, but a nipple nonetheless. And there I am, you know. And yet, when you know, I was like, oh, well, that's because we just learned how to cure bacon in charcuterie class. And I had a slab of bacon, like belly, a whole belly, and we hadn't trimmed the skin off.
You garnished it with nipples.
I cut the slab and rendered it to make the sauce, and yet there happened to be this whole nipple that made it in.
The rogue nipple that got in there.
God, man.
The rogue nipple.
That's funny.
That's a name for a book right there, The Rogue Nipple.
A culinary tale.
Yeah, there you go.
The rogue nipple. Danielle, can you real quick zap everyone? I'm going to let you take your pick. I want you to zap everyone with, man, how come no one notified me that I'm not running the right angle on my mic? Can you zap everyone real quick with either, this is chef's choice, with either the heart recipe or the Roadhouse Snow Goose steakhouse dish?
Oh, I want to talk about the Snow Goose.
Set the stage how everybody shit talks snow geese all the time.
Yeah, so a very, very common conversation that takes place is, hey, what'd you do this weekend? Oh, we got into some snow geese. I got this great recipe, let me tell you. And they go on and on and on and on, and then they tell you to eat the rock, throw the meat away, and then I chuckle.
People still use that joke.
Yeah,
and then you eat. The board,
and then I listen to the whole story every time. Like it's the first time I've heard it, and laugh and
you
cry
do?
Inside. Oh, I laugh because I'm like, I can't believe he's telling me this.
So you go along with it.
Well,
joke with me, I try to meet them with the stone coldest, most indifferent face they've ever seen.
Really, I can't. Yeah. I can't do that.
I'm like,
yeah,
that's not quite right. The viewers can't see the face I just tried to make, but no, I don't. And then board.
You looked confused in that one. Oh, which would be a good way.
I'm not like good at that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So that conversation happens a lot, and I get so sick of it, and I get so sick. It's almost like an offense to me, in a ways, to say how much I love eating snow goose, and they're like, "Let me tell you how bad it is." I'm like, "Are you calling me a bad cook?" It could be. I mean, my husband's the only one who really eats my food, and he'll eat anything. But so to everybody out there who does not like snow goose, or that you throw it away, or whatever you do with it, let me change your mind a little bit. I call it the steakhouse goose, and this is something I do with my sous vide, and I cook it for anybody who comes over for dinner. That's usually what I'm cooking is a snow goose. So I'll take it out of the freezer, let it sit in the fridge for a couple days or however long till I'm ready to cook. Pat it dry, a little salt, a little pepper. Sometimes I'll get crazy with garlic or thyme. And then a little bit of ghee in there, which is clarified butter. Butter that the milk solids have been taken out. It gives it a higher smoke point, which you don't really need it for sous vide. I think ghee has a better flavor, because I think ghee, the difference between ghee and clarified butter, I think they toast it differently. But anyway, that's besides the point. So, and then I put it in my vacuum sealer, sous vide it, and I usually do it about 128 to 130, which is on the rare side of medium rare. So that way, when all of the breast meat is finished, comes out of the bag, they're all cooked to the same temperature.
So about 2 hours at 130.
Yeah. So my rule of thumb is for every half inch thickness of meat, you should be sous vide-ing at least for 30 minutes. And that's if it's already sort of like defrosted, pull it out to room temperature. If it's frozen, just like add an hour or more to that. So every half inch. And then the funny thing about geese, when you cook them, they like to sort of condense and shrink up and they get thicker. So I always add at least another 30 minutes to that. So if that geese is only an inch thick, I'm still going to sous vide it for about an hour and a half, maybe.
So because it's an inch thick, but as you cook it, it's going to become an inch and a half
thick. Yeah, it's about three-quarter inch thick. Half inch, three-quarter inch for a snow. And so I take it out, pat it dry, either seared in a cast iron or on the grill, because everybody wants their steak cooked a little bit differently. So I always start at like the rare side. Medium rare is sort of the baseline, because that's what I like to eat. Unless somebody else wants it longer, then I just sear it for a little bit longer. And that is hands down, everybody is obsessed with it. I love it. It's like my steakhouse goose.
Good.
That's it.
Thanks.
Pretty simple.
It is. Really simple.
Skin on, skin off. Just the breast meat we're talking about here?
Yeah, this is just the breast meat. No skin.
Have you ever rendered out all your goose fat?
I've tried. I still have some. I think I froze it. I don't know if that's probably a terrible idea. But sometimes if I get like only two geese and their thigh meats, usually like in that pocket between the thigh and the bottom of the breast plate, exactly. We'll always have like a lot of fat in there. And so if I'm just cooking dinner that night, I'll just throw it in the pan and let it sort of melt to brown the food that I'm cooking. And then the fat melts out and you're still left with some like kind of collagen-ish tissue. I'll throw that out and then brown the meat in there.
Yeah, you can freeze it and then render it.
You can?
Yeah. Like when you gut a goose and you reach into that gutting incision, those big fat globs like right in the bottom.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's you can freeze those things
by the
and
tail,
render them out.
You can get a hunk of it.
Yeah, stuff's good. Yanni, final thoughts?
I was going to say how much we were talking about thawing meat, and I was thinking about what I did a bunch this summer because my house and kitchen were in disarray. And so
Of a remodel.
Yeah, once we had the new deck up, which is like kind of a dark brown board, and it's south-facing, so it gets the sun.
You thaw your meat out in the heat?
Direct. Well, in those pinch moments, right? Because you're like painting, and then you're like, "Oh shit, it's six," you know, and the one kid's melting, and you're like, "I need some thawed out meat fast." I don't have a sink, so you know, running underwater is out. There's nothing. So yeah, I was gonna say that's one of the great things about like the vac sealed, like heavy duty. We use Weston bags. They're heavy duty enough where literally you can like run, grab it out of the freezer, and then like slide it out onto the deck in the sun. And like 30 minutes later, I run out there and I've got something to work with.
You just hope the health department has to come by. Right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Or OSHA during our remodel.
That's good. That's your concluder?
Yes.
Nice work.
Thanks.
Eduardo, finals, concluders?
I think on my end, I'm excited for, archery season's wrapping this weekend here in Montana, and that means rifle, and then, bird season's kind of upon us. I'm just excited to be out eating a little bit more. Foraging season's coming to foraging for non-animal based things is coming to a pretty quick halt here.
It's going to be hidden under some snow, man.
Yeah, it's gonzo. Yeah, I'm going to go out this weekend, and I was thinking about it. I was like, man, I think the only thing that'll be out there worth picking if I see it is rose hips, and that's about it. So, yeah.
We found, like, at the bottom of scree slides and stuff, we found queen bleats melting out of, you know, that can survive.
This time of year?
Yeah. Snow, frozen, right? And you still find queen bleats.
Yeah.
That are fine.
Wow.
That's one of the things that surprised me. Like one of the latest things I've picked have been queen bleats. We've even picked frozen queen bleats. They can thaw and be fine.
Bet they're great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Butternut, that's like the kind of the the last thing you find of the stuff that like dies, you know?
Oh, I do, and I do. Sorry, I do have a clothing
stop. Oh, real quick, do you deal with rose hips? What do you like to do with them?
Jam? In the past, we've worked with it once before, but I don't do a ton with them beyond like teas and whatnot.
Yeah.
But chutneys, jams, they sweeten. There's a ton of vitamin C and antioxidants in there. They're easy to pick, and they're not hard to find.
And they live everywhere.
They live everywhere. So
there's really no one who can't go find them.
I just don't like going home empty-handed, so I kind of feel like I got to come home with something.
Oh, sorry. We got to bring up the spiny rose hip that we ran into in Washington.
Spineless. Yeah, all rose hips. The wild rose.
No. The fruit itself. Oh, remember?
Yeah. You ever see a rose hip where the rose hip, the fruit is spiny?
Mm-mm. No. Did you guys come across that on your archery hunt?
Hunting Southeast Washington.
Yeah.
We puzzled over it.
Yeah, I mean, I know there's a lot of different varieties of rose hips out there.
Spiny.
Yeah. Huh. So freezing, we're talking about that a bunch. So I have a thought on freezing that I can close with is that I do believe that freezing is one of the greatest inventions of the modern world when it comes to eating and sustainability for the human race. It's just being able to freeze things is amazing. And but I freeze. I try to be real conscious when I'm breaking down an animal. And I know a lot of folks, it's good. It's pretty easy and it can be a super boon to timing when you need a quick meal is to have your steaks already cut into two per bag. It's you and the missus thawed out. I tend to almost always freeze the whole muscles when I can. It's kind of like that protective skin on the tongue we were talking about. Just things happen. Your bags get punctured when the freezer, you know, it's in the back and you uncover it in March and there's a little frost burn on it somewhere. And I feel like even to the point where I will freeze whole muscles with silver skin on the whole nine yards, yeah. Because I know that when it thaws back out, if something's happened to it, I don't want to lose the good stuff inside. So I'll trim it off the day I'm cooking it in March or April or May or whenever it is. So that's just one thing I like to do is I like to freeze whole muscles when I can.
Yeah, I do like freezing the loin.
Yeah.
There's always, you kind of want to leave that silver skin on there. But then the thing that's in the back of my head is like, man, when I give it to somebody, then I got to explain it to them and shit. And then what if they don't remember to do it? They're going to have a negative experience. So I'm always weighing in my head. I'll sometimes make a piece really perfect where anyone in the world would thaw it out and be like, this is ready to cook. This looks beautiful.
Yep.
And I'll put a star on the package or two stars.
Double
in
star.
In extreme cases. And then I'll kind of like look and be like, oh, that's one that I could give to someone and there's going to be no puzzlement.
Yeah.
They're going to get it and they're going to get it, right?
I want a double starred gift from that guy.
Sounds nice.
Yeah.
Chris?
Not much of a concluder, but I would like if we could like engineer some sort of cook-off between Eduardo and Danielle.
Oh.
Mostly because not even like the competition side of it, but I just want an excuse to eat really well. Like that's all it is. I just want to be like a judge just to...
The contest is who can give me the most food.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we can film it or whatever, you know, but...
Well, I think, one of my thoughts is if I've never hunted snow geese, but I'd love to go on a snow goose hunt. And what I would like to do is I'll take those legs if you're going to take the breast and you got your steakhouse recipe. And I'd love to confit those legs.
Oh, yes. I love.
Ooh, that's a good idea.
The legs are so good because they have a lot of fat on them. Yeah. They braise nice.
We should all plan. We should all just go out for snow geese in spring.
I was saying to Ben O'Brien yesterday, I was saying there needs to be a meat eater rendezvous, like a full-blown powwow where
snow
like
goose
everybody
rendezvous.
Descends to just do a full-blown
where would you want
hunting session, eating
like
session.
For the spring hunts, you know?
No, where?
I don't know, over in your old neck of the woods.
Yeah, by the Missouri.
Yeah.
Are they there late in the season?
Well, they have that spring season where you don't even need a plug. You can use electron. They take the gloves
no
off, man. Electronic calls, no plugs.
Yeah, it's crazy. My husband built his own homemade electronic collar. It didn't work.
He didn't just want to buy a Fox Pro or whatever?
You know, he does that a lot. He wants to do everything himself, bless his heart. So it's like, you end up, like, you could just spend the money and get it, but he loves doing things himself. But yeah, and because he wanted it, like, white and all, like, the whole, like, 9 yards and, like, multiple speakers out throughout the thing. It did work.
Sound system.
Yeah, because whenever...
Surround sound goose calling?
Yeah, because, like, in the middle of the day when you're not doing anything, it's nice to have some music out there.
Yeah, gotcha. Seth, concluders?
I got a question.
Okay.
For my concluder. Back to Oregon meat. I've heard
Oregon or Oregon?
Oregon.
Okay.
I've heard multiple times people say that, like, freezing Oregon meat is no good.
Yeah. Freezing livers is rough on livers. Freezing heart doesn't matter.
Yeah, that was my question.
I wouldn't hesitate to freeze a kidney. Freezing livers just changes the liver. Like, the same thing that went in the freezer doesn't come out.
Gotcha.
I think it's kind of like
what happens to a fish fillet.
Yeah, you cook it and you wind up with this kind of like...
To get like mushy?
Deflated. And... No, the opposite of mushy.
Oh.
It's like you take it out and it lets off a shitload. It lets off a lot of water. You take the slice, you throw it in the pan. It kind of deflates. It gets a little... it's almost like it's not so much you'd say like it's an absolute no-no, because it's not an absolute no-no, but it's definitely not. It's something you just eat it when you get it.
My guess
it ain't that big.
My guess is liver fall into the category of muscle?
No,
heart does. So my guess would be that it's just the it's a more naturally tender, the makeup of that structure is delicate, right? Gotcha. And so when you're freezing it, you are rupturing through expansion,
yep,
the cellular walls of protein and that organ. And so when you thaw it, it's losing its natural structure and web.
It's a real letdown.
Mm-hmm.
And especially dishes, if you're making dishes like liver pate and dips and things like that, just isn't the same.
So if you're messing with the liver, you want to mess with it like right away.
First thing you kill a younger deer, take the liver home, slice it in quarter inch slices, soak it. My mom used to soak it in water with a lemon squeezed into it, or even like those, she used to buy those little bottles of lemon juice.
Mm-hmm.
Put lemon juice in water because it's a little bit acidic and a little bit of, it somehow seems to dissolve and pull out more blood. People take liver home and soak it in salted water. People take it home and soak it in water, but it does. You'll pull out and the water becomes like a rose color. Like, it's definitely dissolving and pulling out some of the blood, and then cook it. It's just the first thing you should eat. Freeze all the other stuff. That's my concluder. Danielle, you kind of got your concluder. Do you want another concluder?
No, I think I'm good.
All right. Good job, everyone. Next time we all get together, we need to spend a little bit of time talking about game hearts. Till then, thank you.